Council.
Bloody clever.
February 6th. We have no apologies. We have Michael online. And I promise Michael that I won't swear when you come on board. It's nothing to do with you personally. It's just I got a fright. And now we're going to attendance. And we're all here. Confirmation of the agenda. Conflict of interest. You can apply them when you need to. Public forum. On the public forum, I'd like to welcome to the table Jerry Eckhoff.
Excuse me, I'm just adjusting to
all these things here. Yeah.
And you've got a microphone, thank you. If I'm too loud, just go like that, or as it happens to me all the time, don't worry.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, councillors. Thank you for the opportunity. I have to say that convention normally requires former councillors to remain silent on the very matters that encourage them probably to stand in the first place. I think that convention is misplaced at best. There is simply no moral authority in preserving this unwritten covenant of coerced indifference on topical issues. Now, let me declare my interests, because I am here to talk about conflicts of interest, and my interests in water. I am a consented water user through the Manuhirakia community scheme, and I trickle irrigate trees. I keep my lawn green in the event of fire, which is a common threat, and I'm delighted to see commercial or bigger users of water keeping the valley floors green as possible. 20 years ago, we had a taste of what fire can do in our area and through our property, actually. Today, I feel compelled to come to this public forum to spell out what I see as the disenfranchising of rural New Zealand. Other synonyms for such things are the marginalisation or exclusion of rural voices, as I understand it. It is, in my view, insidious, and it is constant. Just a few short months ago, we all voted for those who we assumed would best represent our interests. Now, because our duly elected representatives are seemingly to be excluded or are excluded, council, by default, is also now excluding the multi-thousands of people just like me and others who voted for these people to represent them on this council. If their voices are not being heard around this council, my voice is not being heard either, indirectly. We have this thing called a representative democracy, and what is happening, in my view, is neither representative nor democratic. We, the people, voted for candidates who are apparently now excluded from representing us on the council on this most crucial issue, water, and that faces us, especially those of us who live in Central Otago. And I believe up to five councillors potentially could be excluded on this conflicts of interest issue. I was stunned, quite frankly, to hear of this exclusion based on this alleged conflict of interest. And my mind went back to Environment Southland, who allowed a councillor who was a fish and game, I think, area manager to both participate fully and vote. Fish and game have a pecuniary interest. They rely on fishing licences and duck shooting licences, all about water. And yet rural councillors, who happen to be consented water users one way or another, and who may well have a historical, a cultural, a traditional use right, are to be set aside. How is that possible? Why are we changing from what I saw as a relatively inclusive approach to a confrontational one of urban versus rural? And I want to draw your attention, if I may, there is an elephant in the room on this issue. A huge conflict of interest, yet it seems to be ignored. And I refer to the representation that Ngāi Tahu has sitting around this table with full voting and speaking rights, advocating for their interests and possibly only their interests. I don't know, but that's as I understand it to be. Surely every councillor is here to represent and indeed even those who are not elected, are here to represent the best interests of Otago and not any one particular interest group or ethnicity, for that matter. How then is it possible for the council to exclude rural voices, yet no challenge has been heard to the unelected representatives and their singular interests? Let me just say I have an unequivocally wide respect for Ngāi Tahu, Mr. Ellison in particular, and indeed I have advocated for Ngāi Tahu at a public meeting many years ago on the Greenstone issue. So I don't know that I can be challenged on that particular issue. I am here talking about the conflicts of interest and not about ethnic or racial groups. But as far as a conflict is concerned, a family member or a friend as a water user is enough to be accused of a conflict of interest, and I've made something of a study of this. So how do we find councillors from rural New Zealand without any family or friends or associations with water users? And that is if the letter of the law is applied on conflicts. We have such a thing as the spirit of the law, and I think that applied certainly during my nine years on the council, where I think others recognised that there were conflicts. But we managed it in such a way, and everybody approached that issue with an open mind, and I think that was reflected by the way 6A went through with, I think, in the finish, unanimously. I suggest to you, in my closing remark, in my 5 minutes, I could go on for 55, but your prime function, councillors, is to remember that this is a representative democracy and to be inclusive and not to judge other councillors' conflict of interests. This is a matter for personal integrity of each and every councillor to approach these difficult issues, and there's no pretense that it's not a difficult issue, with an open mind. And that is the key. That is absolutely the key, to approach these issues with a completely open mind. Some of you may have read my article in the paper just last week or so. In the UK, they have ruled out disqualifying people because they have alleged predetermination. If David Cameron, the Prime Minister, said, you are here representing a grouping of people, you are entitled to come here and do that. But keeping an open mind, I think, Madam Chair, is one of the most important aspects that any councillor can bring to the table. I think this issue is such an important one, and I know ECAN had problems in the past. I think it is such an important issue that a judicial review is needed in the High Court to clarify as to what actually constitutes a conflict of interest or a vested interest, which we absolutely must have confidence at election time that the people we elect will be entitled to speak on the very issues that we elect them to speak on. That is just such an important part, otherwise we go away from a representative democracy. We all, as I remember, we all used to declare an interest, and the council at that time also understood. And we also accepted and understood the potential conflicts, but I think by and large they were pretty well managed. And I see no reason why that approach can't continue. My plea is this: do not disenfranchise rural voices. We are just as important as anybody else, and we feel as though we're being put upon, I guess, on a national scene with all the rules and regulations. Many of them are required and unnecessary, but we must have those voices advocating on our behalf. We must. There is no second best, and if necessary, this has to go to the High Court to ensure that we do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I've gone over time, and I appreciate the leeway you've given me. If there is anything, any questions or whatever that councillors might have, I'd be happy to try and answer. But
microphone, Marion. Sorry.
Done wrong now. It may help relax you a little to know that at a discussion in Wellington and local government New Zealand in the last 2 days, was actually discussing exactly what you're talking about, that we may need as a whole local government New Zealand, because it isn't just rural city. There are conflicts that occur within cities about this whole issue of conflict of interest. So it is Canterbury's experience, ours, Hawke's Bay's, you name it, has begun to raise a real issue. So we're aware of it.
Well, I have, just on that, I have spoken with Local Government New Zealand, yep. Dr. Mike Reed.
Yes.
And he reminded me of this Localism Act that has nothing to do, it's an English Act, that was passed in 2011, where they have instructed local government to allow those with a predetermined point of view to sit and speak and vote on issues, because it allows them to speak on behalf of people who cannot and do not sit around this table.
So it is on the agenda. I don't know whose agenda. And just to say, there's also a defence. The scary thing is that if we were to go ahead and somebody didn't like our decision, they can take a vote. They can take a case against us and have our decisions declared null and void. And it is in that interest of defence.
I understand that, Madam Chair. I would say that there have been covert allegations in the past that have come to nobody's ever bothered to go because
they feel
that everybody's taken a very pragmatic approach to these things. But, you know, I could talk about General Pinochet and a judge.
No,
you're our judges. And whose wife was a member of Amnesty International. And the case was thrown out as a result of that. It's an extraordinarily widespread issue, especially amongst staff, of all things.
Are there any questions for Mr. Eckhoff? There being none, thank you very much, Mr. Eckhoff, for coming.
Thank you, Councillor.
Turning to the next thing on the agenda is the there are no presentations scheduled for this meeting, is a confirmation of the minutes. They are the minutes of the 22nd of January. Can I have somebody move? Yes, please. Thank you, Carmen. And second, that these are an accurate record. Can I have a seconder? Alexa? All those in favour?
Aye.
I say aye. And against? Carried. Whoops, she goes back to the next thing again. So the next point on the agenda is, the minutes of the 12th of February 2020 Council meeting. Somebody like to move that these are accurate? Michael Decker, seconded? Thanks, Andrew. Any questions? All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
And against? Carried. If we go to number 8 on the agenda, which is action, status of council resolutions. Has anybody got any queries or questions about this? Bringing you up to date.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Andrew.
Can I just clarify the disposal of poison services assets, 11.3, or second item under 11.3. OIC to consult with the community and propose sale of poison services assets, include the Galloway land as part of the proposed sale. That was supposed to occur some time ago, but it's part of the 2021 annual plan process.
Yep.
It's assigned to operations, so so we will know I imagine. At the end of the annual plan process, we will be aware.
Yes. So the thought outcome was that we would ask. No, Gavin's shaking his head at me, so he should probably.
Okay. So it's the end of that financial year, then the 2021. We will be aware of the outcome.
Andrew, do you want to comment?
Yes. Through you, Madam Chair. We're working on the operational plan, which we will bring to council next month. And the intention was for council to make that decision about disposal after it has received the operational plan. The report's quite correct in that we were thinking about running this through the annual plan process, but for the reasons Mr. Donnelly gave at the Finance Committee, we've decided to decouple it from the annual plan and run a separate but kind of parallel consultation process, because it's not a statutory thing, unlike annual plan. So the answer to your question is, in the next few months, we would expect to know the answer to the question of what does the public think.
Okay. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hilary, you wanted some notion on the actions?
Delegations, early in 2020, when will that be?
That's 11.3. It'll be, so that's to do with delegations around particularly regulatory and consent activity. So we'll look to have that to the end of March meeting. We're considering the end of this month, but we just didn't have time to get that prepared.
Okay. Sorry?
One more on
Alexa. Oh, sorry, Alexa. Sorry.
The Lake Hayes culvert, consultant preparing cost estimate for scoping exercise. I wonder when we might see this, given it's 5 months down the track now, to even have the consultant preparing costs for scoping.
Yes, through Madam Chair, that scoping cost estimate has been prepared and I'm happy to send it to councillors for information.
Please.
I wrote to the other parties on the 20th of December. I've received a response from QLDC saying they would support cost share on that. I'm still awaiting a response from NZTA and the Department of Conservation.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
That's great.
Any other questions? No, we therefore remove to the chairperson's report. I move from the chair that this report is received. Can I have a seconder? Alexa? It's pretty brief. Mm-hmm. Any questions? There being none, we move that the council receives this report. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
And against? Carried. We move straight to the chief executive's report. And the thing is that the council receives this report. I'll move from the chair. Is there a seconder?
Seconded.
Thank you.
Can I just ask a question before the Chief Executive?
Absolutely.
Sorry, Sarah, I think just commend you really for going out into North Otago and looking at some properties and examples on the ground there, I think, and extend that offer into other areas as well, certainly my area too. When it comes to, I see you visited a farm,
mm-hmm.
and that farm, the standard of infrastructure on that farm, was that at the upper or the top 25%, or was it at the...
I'm not an expert about standards, but I would say it was a fairly impressive operation in terms of what it was achieving, particularly with pumping, having to pump water sort of between, a couple of hundred feet, I guess, as well. So my impression was that it was a pretty clean operation and
it was an example of that you'd or that council would like to see an example of an operation that you would hope would be replicated elsewhere, or was it one that
it's probably, you know, I don't know the compliance history of the farm or anything like that, so I'm only making a layman's judgment, and so, you know, I think I'd hesitate to say it's an example, but my impressions were that it was a very tidy operation. It was a dairy farm. So on that basis, I was there for the positive impression. But I didn't see the whole farm, and nor am I aware of any compliance issues or anything else which might suggest something different.
Well, I mean, the purpose of the question really was just around, was there any discussion with them at the time around, the topical issue on short-term consents, and would that, the standard of infrastructure that you've probably seen on that property, would that have been achievable under a short-term consent? Was there any discussion with the owners about that?
So I asked a number of questions around it, I didn't really ask about short-term consent so much as bankability. I think the farmer gave some feedback around that in response. But I also asked questions about, for example, farm environment plans and whether they should be mandatory or voluntary and the benefits of those. And was very interested to understand that particular farmer felt mandatory was actually perfectly fine, provided that what was audited in the farm plan actually made a difference on the ground to the environmental impact. So that was an interesting perspective, and actually NOIC generally seemed to have that view around farm plans. So that was some of the discussion that we had.
Any further questions? Yes. Carmen.
Mrs. Gardner, may I ask you on the last part, following Councillor Kelleher,
You visited a wetland restoration, which is more than a decade in the making. Can you tell us a wee bit about that? And that would have been very interesting.
It was really interesting. Interesting in terms of management, because, you know, it's more than 10 years old. Yeah. It's done extremely well. The amount of bird life is actually quite incredible. But, of course, the ongoing management of a wetland like that, things like sediment deposition and also how you manage the growth of plants and you know, at times you'll need to do some breaking up of plants and some movement and those sorts of things was the greatest part of the discussion. So, but, you know, definitely a very consolidated piece of work that had taken place over a period of time, where my impression was that there was a big commitment from the farmer, particularly that I was talking to, in order to make that project work. And it was very impressive from what I could see.
Thank you. Andrew, followed by Brian.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My question is probably for Gavin, and it relates to the recent flooding. In the second paragraph, paragraph 11, where it refers to the assessment, damage to the schemes, infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And I just wondered, Gavin, whether that assessment would also include our ability, along with the community, to pump water from some of the low-lying areas. And I use Paratai as an example because that's where there was some email traffic and concern, etc. And I realise it's not totally our responsibility, but we're part of the solution along with the local community. So does that assessment include our capacity in that area as well, or is it just very much focused on the infrastructure and the damage?
Through you, Madam Chair, we have two projects underway which are looking at the performance of the Tairi Flood Protection Scheme and the Lower Clutha Flood and Drainage Scheme. So the Clutha Scheme Review is the place to be looking at levels of service around installed pump capacity and whether the community wants us to increase that level of service and the issues that go with that, amongst a number of other issues. We do have a report coming to the March 11 meeting of Infrastructure Committee which describes this flood and its impacts, and we'll have a bit more information. So again, we'll cover this issue in a bit more detail at that time. But overall, the scheme's performed well, and we protected about 20,000 hectares of land. So we've had some damage, and it's also revealed some pre-existing defects, but overall worked as intended.
Brian.
Yeah, the pandemic planning, it says pandemic planning is currently being addressed through emergency management Otago. So is that just in relation to the OSC staff, or is that a greater, more regional perspective and responsibility?
So we're doing two things.
Yeah.
Both of those, if you like. One is that out of really HR and health and safety, we are pandemic planning for the organisation.
Yeah.
And that I consider needs to also think about you as governors and how we would function if we were in a situation.
Without us.
Hallelujah.
Oh, don't start. Sorry.
I said nothing.
We've just found the cause of the pandemic.
And how we would function with that. So we are doing that because there are, we have adopted the Ministry of Health guidelines, but of course, there's just really, you know, in the event that coronavirus reaches our shores and we are doing things other than being precautionary, then we need to just be able to think about how we would be able to maintain aspects of our work at the same time as we allowed or made provision for staff who needed to have stand-down periods and quarantining and those sorts of things.
So it's just an ORC internal?
That is an ORC one. The emergency management Otago piece is consistent with what's happening around the country generally, I think, which is just taking a broader view and having a look at that in terms of how that might affect us regionally and the sorts of demands that there may be on services. So that's really how it's in two pieces, if you like. So two different parts, parts of our organisation working at two different levels.
Yeah, I mean, of course, this is a very topical issue, and depending on what perspective you believe will follow, it could ramp up quite quickly.
Yes, it could.
So, like, what's our governance response? Will we be, you know, I mean, this is this our extent of our governance involvement, and then we just wait for the magic wand, or do we become a little bit more privy about what's planned?
Right. So, well, at the moment,
yeah,
we are simply taking the advice of the Ministry of Health.
Okay.
And that is available to everybody on their website, and okay, that's updated regularly.
Really?
So that's what we've adopted for operations generally. So there's, apart from that, there's nothing else we're doing. But in terms of planning, what we're trying to ascertain, and, you know, if you felt that you wanted to have a further workshop or conversation about it, that we could do that, is around, okay, in the event that we actually have people who become ill,
yes,
how do we then make the organisation work? So, for example, we know in flu season, we have very dedicated staff who feel pressure to come to work. And so, you know, what is the messaging? What is the support we need to give people so that they
don't
come to work, for example? If people need to be quarantined, what does that mean in terms of the provision we make as an employer around things like sick leave? Or leave that's relevant for that kind of...
I mean, does it go even further than that in terms of our responsibility? Like, we own the port, the ability to have, if the virus ramped up quickly, to have a functioning port or a functioning bus system? Does it...
I think I would expect that the port company is doing their own pandemic planning, just as the bus company would be, because we're not the only ones that are doing this kind of work. We're also not reinventing the wheel, so other regional councils and city councils have kindly shared some of the work that they've done as well, so that we're not reinventing the wheel. The other thing we think about is, you know, what are our essential services versus the things that we could park for a time if we had to. And also thinking about things like if we have people who needed to be quarantined, you know, have they got remote access into the organisation and that sort of thing, if they, you know, so they could continue to work if that was what we worked out. So there's quite a lot in that, but my view is it's very important for us to think about those things now rather than be in a position where we actually have to make some snap decisions and might not make the right ones.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you. It's been moved and seconded, and I move that the council receives this report. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And against, no. So we move on to the proposed change to the regional transport plan.
Move.
Who moved?
I'm happy to move.
Yep, thank you. People, what I'm intending to do is move and then second it, Alexa.
Yes.
Oh, I'm going to have... that's my point. Excuse me for a minute while I... Yep. What I'm trying to do is move the motion always at the beginning and sense so that it manages the conversation if we take off.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any... Welcome to the table, Gary and Gavin. Are there any questions of Gary or Gavin to the paper? Mm. Seem to get a very clear steer from Mr. Baxter.
Yes.
The Commissioner. In paragraph 13. So if there are no questions...
I'd like to make a bit of a comment.
Yes, dear.
I can't phrase it as a question if I really have to. But, I just really want to thank Gary and Catherine.
Yes.
This has been, and I would like to say, if I have to do as a question, how did you manage to put together a process that worked so quickly and so well? Because it has absolutely... And it's so. I've had so many emails from people from Queenstown and today and yesterday about seeing that report and how delighted they are. I really want to thank you for that, but I don't know if there's a model or some angel dust that you poured on it or something, but it worked really well.
You did it all online, Alexa.
Did it all online.
Gavin, are you going to say something? Are you going to pour cold water on our enthusiasm?
No.
Good.
I think it was a very narrow matter being consulted on, so I think it was consequentially simple to deal with, but staff worked very hard to meet the ambitious timeline we have for the implementation pathway.
Really appreciated.
Carmen.
I just like
Sorry, Brian.
No, I'd just like to echo what Councillor Forbes says. It's not only that, it's the fact that you got to read everything. We really appreciate that. The submissions were absolutely very interesting. They told you a lot. You could see they want the increased service, they want the bigger ferries, they want to be able to take the capacity times. And they're asking, please, can we have more of it and can you extend your hours? And we look forward to seeing this, and I thank you for the paper.
Brian.
Yeah, I mean, the whole cost issue is being handled separately through the annual plan process. I mean, is this resolution subject to the annual plan sorting out the finance? I mean, the whole issue of finance wasn't really a discussion point yet. That's my question.
Gavin?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's correct. It was a very narrow consultation on should the regional public transport plan be amended to enable this to be considered. It did not put cost information, and so the annual plan process or the process in parallel with the annual plan process will have that information, and there may very well be a different lot of feedback coming through when we ask those sorts of questions.
Okay, so this isn't the final resolution. The annual plan process in terms of the trial is the next step.
Through you, Madam Chair, there's a whole implementation set of decisions that need to be made, and this is just one on the way. There's an annual plan, questions around whether NZTA would fund it, etc. Yeah. So it's just one step on the way. It's one step forward, but it's definitely not all the steps that need to be taken, and all the decision points at which at any point it could be parked up and suspended or whatever.
Okay. We won't get the bubbly out yet.
It's a very strong platform, though, Brian.
Before I call on Andrew, I just want to clarify something here, because you two may have been at Miss Thimajig's. We have agreed the money for this until June. The annual plan is from July the 1st onwards, correct?
It is correct that Council resolved to enter into negotiations around the short-term immediate thing.
Right.
There's also the annual plan thing. And then this is a third thing today, which is around the enabler in the public transport plan.
Thank you. Andrew?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a question for Gavin or Gary, but to achieve the best outcome possible with the trial, how difficult is it to integrate infrastructure, ticketing, routes, etc., bus versus ferry, in the short term? Because I imagine it takes more than just clicking your fingers to have all those different aspects dovetailing into each other. So is that practical in a sense in a short time frame to achieve that?
Through you, Madam Chair. So the trial will be a lot different to the service that we put in, or that we contract for, hopefully, now. So what we're looking at now is pretty much the operation that's happening on the lake. The trial will look at how it integrates with bus services, how it integrates with ticketing, how it integrates with timetables.
Okay.
Thank you.
Michael Deacon.
The message I took from this, Madam Chair, is one, it's a very good report, and well done, Gary, on the way in which you've executed and delivered this to us. But the main message I got was what a highly mobilised community we've got living in the greater Queenstown area, that they came in rapidly with such a positive, enthusiastic, detailed set of submissions.
Absolutely.
A lot of them constructive and helpful and saying how we should do this. And that's all grist to the mill, I'm sure, when it comes to what Gary's just been talking about and the delivery of a service if it goes right through all the processes. And the thing that I'd like to add to what I've just said is that we've got the RPTP coming up for general review, including Dunedin City, including, I hope, places like Cromwell, which we may be embraced into the new five-year plan. And I'm hoping that, say, the city will show the same creativity, positivity, flow of ideas that the Queenstown folks have exemplified.
Yep.
How do we, Gary, have you got a way of enthusing the Dunedin community to look at public transport innovations, alternatives, improvements? Because, boy, we need them here as well. We've got a good system in Dunedin, but the Queenstown folks have shown how you can make a good system a hell of a lot better.
Thank you very much, Steve. Hilary?
Just a comment about the... Somebody said earlier about the ticketing and whatever. I've got a Leguimer in to ask whether the ticketing can deal with the potential subsidisation of ferry services in Queenstown. So hopefully I'll hear back soon.
Good. Thank you. Okay. It's been moved, Kate, seconded Alexa, that the Council receives this report and adopts the proposed variation to the Regional Public Transport Plan as consulted to enable a Lake Wakatipu ferry service to be trialled. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
And against? Carried. Can we now move, please? And you notice that there were four attachments. Thank you very much, the two of you. Thanks, Gary. We're now going to go to the Navigation Safety Bylaw 2029. But just before we do, yes,
yeah, Chair, just declaring that myself and Gretchen are
as
commissioners for this paper, or within this paper. And so I suggest for conflict reasons we should remove ourselves from
Okay, love. Yep. Thank you very much.
We should have said that earlier. Sorry.
Okay. You're happy to move,
yes.
Kate, and... Sorry, I've just got to open this up. Happy to move in a seconder for this, Carmen. And can I welcome our harbour master? I like saying our harbour master, Steve, to the chair. Have everyone's read the papers? Do they understand the issues that are here? Or are there any questions? I have one simple question before you, Brian. The other day I was out looking at Lagoa Siphon on Wanaka. And I was with a man who had on his head, or had on his jacket, harbour master. Does QLDC appoint, because here we are talking about a harbour master for Dunstan, does QLDC appoint people, or do you have any negotiation with them about Wanaka and Wakatipu?
No, ORC delegate the authority for QLDC area.
Okay, so and then they
we
appoint.
We have a similar... set up to the one we're dealing with here. So ORC have delegated maritime responsibility to Central for Lake Dunstan and again for Queenstown in their area. So they have the power to then make their own bylaws and appoint their own harbour masters through the regulatory framework. And obviously the Lake Dunstan piece is the piece we're just dealing with now, and a reversal of that delegation back to ORC's responsibility.
Okay, Brian, you had your hand up.
Yeah, two quick points. The first one, well done, by the way, in terms of the moorings for the long yachts, Kerry's Bay, etc. So that was great to
read. Been very positive.
My question here is not only is this reassessment of the bylaw on the basis of encompassing Lake Dunstan, it seems to me it's also an opportunity to fill any gaps or learning since the last process that we went through, yeah? Well, so it's greater than just Lake Dunstan.
I think so. If I can just sort of put a presse over that, I mean, we revamped the ORC's navigational bylaws and they came into effect last year after a long period of being out of date. So we really refreshed that, and I would have expected to be back here in 5 years' time reviewing those, not this time round so quickly. So and Brian is right that it's a good opportunity to see what we've learned in the past 6 months, and it's obviously a live document, and there's been one or two just amendments in the positioning of stuff within the document and some of the bits of wording, but nothing major that wasn't already there, and just a few tweaks on the central Otago stuff that was already from 2017, so that's relatively new as well. Most of that was encompassed in our bylaw, so we've just framed up some mostly around the water skiing and towing side of things, which is more prevalent in that location, so that we've got that all covered up in the overall overarching bylaw as well.
Very good, thank you.
Okay. Are there any more questions or comments? Carmen.
Sorry, Mr. Rushbeck, because I actually can't find it, but I did read, am I correct, that there is a bylaw that says if you're in Lake Dunstan or that area, you've got to wear your life jacket at all times?
Yes, there are. That's one of the key differences here. There are two potential key issues which will be interesting to see how they come out through the consultation, in that Dunstan have a you must wear a life jacket at all times, and following the consultation process here last year, we ended up with a you must wear it, but you also have a sub-clause that allows the skipper to
some discretion.
Relax discretion. That right. bylaw, and that becomes the skipper's responsibility. It actually works quite well in both arenas. Yes. So, you know, when you're wearing it at all times, there are cases where if you're having a barbecue or you're angry, you might not have a requirement to wear a life jacket, but that's the skipper then takes that responsibility. So there are still six different variations of how to wear your life jacket or not across New Zealand. And as a body of harbour masters, we're pushing for the national body MNZ to make that a standard across the land. And until we get that, unfortunately, we're in this sort of mix and match. So yes, that is a big difference between Central and the ORC's ones. So it'll be interesting to see. And I guess the other contentious issue is around vessel identification, which we've pushed through last year to align with ECAN and a very similar setup to them. When the central bylaws went through in 2017, CODC Council rejected the vessel ID stuff. So that will be potentially something that comes to the fore, I would imagine, as we go through this process as well.
Sorry, dear Harbour Master, but how do you identify the vessel? Do they have a number on them?
You have a name or a registration plate. There's a few options, and the smaller vessels, it's really about contact details somewhere on it, on a kayak or something like that.
Okay.
So when you find them drifted up on the shore, you can at least try and make contact and see if there was anybody in it or not. It's really around safety.
You know, I've never thought about that. I'm a kayaker, and I've never, ever thought about that, so thank you. All right.
Thank you for that.
End of confession. Anybody? We're free now to move the...
I've moved it.
Yes, Kate. The five paragraphs that are up on the board, five statements that are up on the board. Have I a seconder?
Carmen seconded.
Yes, Carmen, thank you. All those in favour, please say aye.
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 And against? It's been carried. Thank you very much for your work, both of you.
Thank you.
So we're now coming to Taumata Arawai. Oh, gosh. The Water Services Regulator Bill submission. And young man, relax. I thought it was a brilliant report. Mm-hmm. It's different from the last time when we sat in front of each other. And what we're doing here is we are... The purpose is to seek the council endorsement. Where is the... Here it is here. We received the report... I'm perfectly happy to move it from the chair. Would somebody like to second this?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Hilary? Okay. Any questions of this report? Let me just see. I have a few.
Very good.
All right?
Okay.
Interesting.
If I go to paragraph 15, many of the issues around how drinking water is managed and regulated extend across all of the three water services. Oh, no. Actually, it's not a question. Sorry, because... What I was thinking about is that this is the several challenges that we've faced.
Mm.
There's Wellington, there's Clutha and Alex in our own area. There's another big one recently too, isn't there? With water, wastewater in New Zealand, I'm conscious of. A really costly one.
About north? No,
this is in this last 6 months.
That's caused a hiccup going into a lake or something.
No, it's just like Wellington where everything's
QLDC.
Collapsed.
QLDC.
No,
the application.
Oh. Right, yeah. Sorry, I can't. Never mind, I've just distracted you.
Wellington's one.
Any other questions?
I had one.
Yep.
Point 37.
So yep.
Let's see what page that's on. But
144.
Havelock North Inquiry, how the Regional Council Regulatory and Duty of Care failings were. I felt that there wasn't any. Thinking around the receiving environment, or do they not have to be?
So the receiving environment for...
For wastewater.
Wastewater.
Because that's the big one that's impacting us, isn't it?
Yes, so the Taumata Arawai will be set up primarily as a drinking water regulator for regulations that are yet to be promulgated. So we're yet to see what they are. They do have an interest in wastewater and stormwater management, which overlaps with our functions that we currently undertake under the RMA. So that was one of the key things that I wanted to clarify in the submission about where those boundaries would lie. And we do have some requirements under the RMA as they interface with drinking water regulations. We have active duties under the Health Act system at the moment to ensure that systems that supply water supply quality water, and when they don't, that they are brought up to scratch quickly, including by providing information if there's issues that we pick up through our other duties. And we also have a requirement under the National Environmental Standard on drinking water quality to essentially protect existing takes from upstream activities that might degrade the quality of water entering them, but no requirement to improve them.
So, can I just have a supplementary thing?
Yes, you can.
And we've got two areas in Queenstown, one Kingston and one Cardrona, where the receiving environment of the wastewater discharge is upstream of the drinking water takes.
Yes.
So how is this adequately covered in the...
Part of the trouble of being able to figure that out is that we're not quite sure what the regulations are going to be. The point that I was trying to make is that currently we take quite a light touch, especially to single-use or domestic takes and domestic wastewater. So we are currently implementing some of the national environmental standards around freshwater at the moment, but they may need to extend further into those smaller systems. And the background reports for DIA around wastewater system performance was pretty damning, and yeah, they will need to improve.
You think you've done enough in this submission to...
Well... It's difficult to go too far because it is just setting up the regulator as a body without necessarily telling us what regulations they're going to enforce. So the regulations they will enforce will be about drinking water, and I think as a consequence there will have to be changes to a whole range of upstream activities, not just urban wastewater systems.
What about Brian?
Can I just understand, my understanding is that the Strathtyre Community Board has asked a number of years for protection of the water around Middlemarch because it is all bore water in a reticulated sewage system. So that, but how would that, how would you see this implementing? Because I mean, they haven't got protected water. There's a whole lot of activities around the township that happen because there is no protection. Would you see that this is a role that they will then be able to go to the regulator and say, we need special regulations or regulations that protect us, where the ORC hasn't done that in the past? And I'm not being critical of the ORC not doing, because I understand that science wasn't there. So that's why it hasn't happened. It's just a need that there isn't any protection.
It's difficult to say, but I think that with a central regulator that's acting at a national level, there's actually someone to go and talk to.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, the arrangement under the Health Act system is that they would need to talk to the public health officer at the DHB, and then they would come to us and say, you know, what's going on. In terms of Strathtyre, I don't know anything about the particular issues there, but I would think that there is a whole lot of land use activities going on there that would need to be carefully managed, and it would take a long time for the underlying bore water to improve because of the lag. And
The water's fine at the moment, but there is nothing stopping it from going wrong. That's a problem.
Under the current regime, ORC does have a duty to ensure that consented uses for human drinking water purposes are maintained. So there could be a question about whether we're doing enough in that space at the moment, but I think it will become much clearer under the new regulations, which we don't currently see yet.
Thank you.
Michael, then Carmen.
I think Brian.
Oh, sorry, Brian. I missed you. Sorry, Brian. Yeah. Brian, Michael, Carmen.
Look, I've read through this submission, And even though the final paragraph says something quite positive, it says the OAS would welcome the practical assistance, best practice and guidance and strong advocacy. But at the end of the day, do you think it's actually a good idea? I mean, you know, working my way through the submission, it was hard to sort of tell. Is it a good idea what they're proposing in principle?
Having read the background stuff, including around the Havelock North Inquiry, it's pretty clear that the current system does not work to protect human health through drinking water systems. And I think that a central regulator around drinking water would bring it up to scratch with gas supplies, electricity, and a whole lot of other arguably less important critical infrastructure.
Okay, maybe you should say that in your submission.
Very good.
Thank you. Michael?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this might be a big stretch and it might be totally unfair. But where's our Havelock North?
What?
Where is our Havelock North?
Gardrona.
So,
I know when Kevin's area had a lot of concerns about the Lower Waitaki Delta.
Perhaps if I just remind you about what we do.
Yep.
So, through our State of the Environment monitoring, we now actively look at the data that comes up where we know, well, in any case, but where we know there's drinking water, if there is something of concern, like E. coli levels above the drinking water standard, we react. And so what we do in that case is we work with public health and we usually will notify the community concerned, provide advice about whether they should drink the water or what treatment's required, etc. Provide some publicity on that and then increase our monitoring program so that we're getting more data to understand what's going on and also source track so we can understand whether or not, say if it's E. coli, where that's coming from. So is it a human effluent issue or is it, you know, a bovine effluent issue or whatever the case may be? So that's the kind of approach that we take, and we more or less now have a standard operating procedure around that, so that we take those actions very seriously. We did that recently with arsenic occurring in the Queensbury area, where we had some elevated levels of arsenic coming through in a couple of one drinking water bore that supplied more than one household, and so we took action there as well. So, there's sometimes a bit of a lag between getting the results, taking the samples and getting the results, but as soon as we see a result that gives us cause for concern, we will then take those steps.
Okay. That's reassuring. Thank you very much, CEO, for that response. That's good. I won't persevere with the question because it would probably be finger in the air stuff, and I think now that you've outlined that standard operating procedure, as you called it, I'm feeling a lot better about our ability to be able to see where a Havelock North might actually pop up. God help us if it doesn't.
Thank
you.
Mind,
Mrs. Gardner's answered that really well, thank you, but what I wanted to know was this. We just talked about how you...
Oh, darling, I think you're...
You do liaise with your the health officer.
Mm-hmm.
With that going central, does that mean that that health officer will now be omitted or will it just be tweaked? Because that's a really important thing to...
Yes, so because the regulations haven't been articulated, it's not clear.
Yeah.
I do believe that the proposal would maintain some interface with the existing system, the Ministry of Health, particularly around issues around, say, chlorination, fluoridation and that kind of thing. And I would anticipate that there would remain some sort of localised, point of contact.
I do have some
sympathy
through the chair, Mrs. Gardner, because there will be some communities out there under the councils that sit below us that are going to be, obviously have to pull their socks up if you like, but there's also a cost, isn't there? And somebody's going to have to, so there's that comfort on one hand, but on the other hand,
that's right.
That's quite hard.
So another piece of this puzzle is the question of amalgamation of a number, say for example, a number of districts who have water supply networks and sewage treatment and
the like, and how that gets managed in the future. And my understanding is that while there was an initial thought that amalgamation may well be mandatory, I understand that that's not likely to be the case now. That's not to say, though, that there isn't an opportunity for areas to come together and have a conversation about that.
Can I, just before we put the motions, can I just make this comment that this is huge for our TAs in terms of cost, and Auckland was sitting very smugly around the table because of they own everything to do with water. They measure how much water goes out and goes out where, the quality, all those sorts of things. And they seem to have much more control, and everyone was looking at them. I'm not suggesting it's a model, but it's. I don't think we're about to see the world continue exactly as it was. The last bit of news is that Bill Bayfield, who is your equivalent in Canterbury, has just been appointed the interim water regulator. In there. So
he's the interim chief executive.
Interim chief executive of the, sorry, of the water regulator. So it's been, oh, sorry, Jim.
Where do you see the likes of, in the Waitaki, where we've got the Takaraki, the Georgetown, those schemes that six schemes amalgamated, took their supplies back off council because it was exceptionally inefficiently run, and now they're saved, their costings at 35% of what it was, yet the water is as good as gold. So are they still going to be able to exist, or are we going to see...
You think?
I think... I don't think anyone really knows the answer at this point. I think all we know is that we're working through a process as the three water reforms come through. So there is, under the mayoral forum, there is representatives from all councils across the districts, and I'm the one that sits on that group from ORC, and we are discussing, you know, where we can, everything from where can we could just share knowledge and expertise through to how we can work together better through to what are the potential amalgamations, what are the different configurations, how would functions be shared or not. So those discussions are happening in the light of the three waters, and in due course, as they sort of form and business cases get developed, they will come through to the various councils for discussion. So no one knows. There is a regulator. This is just a bill to put the regulator in place. The regulations haven't been written, but as Sarah alluded to, the central government's given a time frame for which voluntary kind of collaboration in terms of working out how particularly the TAs work together to implement these reforms before they consider any mandatory action.
Right, so the likes of that group will be given the appropriate time to start talking?
Yeah, and they are part of the conversation now.
They will. I think it will also all depend on whether or not there's any shift to the size and type of supply scheme that gets pulled into the regulation. So that's also not certain.
So if freshwater is huge for us, three waters is enormous for all the TAs. It's huge.
This is surmising, but I wouldn't underestimate also that there may well be impacts on us in terms of our responsibilities, particularly around providing information around things like what we know about where supplies are and those sorts of things. And also some further expectations for us. So I totally agree with the Chair. It falls into the TA camp more so than ours, but I would also expect some change and possibly some increase in our responsibility around how we manage this.
People, I'm happy to move on. I want to move one first, receives this report, and you've seconded that, Hilary. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
And against? Carried. And thank you very much for that. Don't move. The next one is I want a mover and a seconder for either A or B. I'll be happy to do it. I'd be happy to move, lodge the draft submission, subject to any changes made today, under the delegation from the ORC. It either goes from the staff or the ORC. I'd be very happy to move it from the ORC. Can I have a seconder? Hilary, all those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
And against? Carried. Thank you, people. Thank you very much. And as I said, I found, and I read the entire lot.
Me too, it's a great read.
It was a very good report.
Yeah. Thank
you. On a very difficult subject. I've just lost it again. I'm just coming back.
Okay, so
we're up to Eco Fund. Is that right? Yes, we're up to Eco Fund Decision Panel.
Yeah.
And we're going to move from there that the Council approves a change to the Eco Fund Decision Panel Terms of Reference to allow the Chair of the Eco Fund, one Michael Deeker, to appoint a decision panel of three additional councils for each round of funding. And we note that once they have accepted their appointment, they'll be up to the March 2020. The chair is Michael Deeker. On the last panel, Kate, was it you and me?
And Alexa, I think.
And Alexa.
Yeah.
So we three are knocked out for the next panel. Michael, would you like to move this?
Yeah, I'm happy to move it. I thank Lisa for this brief paper. I think the suggested amendments are just absolutely fine. And I note that the meeting being heralded there is only 5 weeks away, probably, so we need to get on to it. I will seek to have a panel which is as representative as all the previous ones have been, that is of a mix of City, Central and Moeraki plus the Kate and Carmen electoral.
Molyneux,
that's the one. So I would like to hear from anybody who is enthusiastic, I certainly am, about this next meeting of the Eco Fund in the next week or two, so we can get it all settled and look forward to the first round.
Nice.
So
you'd move it, and Kate, are you seconding it?
I'm happy to second it on the basis of making sure this is widespread. Just taking that further, though, and I just want to make sure we're clear, the fact that three of us have already done it, if there are no one else available,
no.
Then we could be on there again, is what I mean.
Of course you could.
Yeah, and thank you.
Yep. Oh, okay. Right. So it's been moved and it's been seconded. There are no... Brian.
Yeah, I'd just like to follow up on a comment I made at the last meeting. This morning I attended a workshop at Tomahawk, where we kindly provided 26 grand. And that actually, you know, fitted in well. I mean, it's a significant funding. And it fitted in the community-driven projects to protect, enhance and promote Otago's environment. And you know, I say it again, you know, like Andrew approached me towards the end of last year saying, well, actually, you know, we're doing our bit, but we're feeling isolated from the council. You know, like we've got this information, we'll fill in our report on a technical basis. So, and the outcome through that process was via Gwyneth and the science manager, that a guy, Sam, turned up today, and he's a coastal scientist, so he was able, you know, there was that connection between what they're doing and what we're doing, and he was able to offer some comment and insight so that we're all on the same page, because this is such an important part of, like, for example, science. We can't do all the science ourselves, so we need a strategy as a council to dovetail, connect with all these community groups. And so my question is that, you know, should we in the terms of reference also have some way of building that connection? So we're not just saying, here's your money, tell us how you spent it, goodbye. Even the regulatory processes, projects, you might find that there needs to be a connection with Richard as the director, so he can actually say, well, you know, well done, and that fits in with... So we're working together, as opposed to... maybe the CE might have a comment on this. It's just, like, do we just give them the money and say, well done? But ideally it actually fits in our overall strategy, you know, that whether it's regulatory or whether it's biodiversity, and we can offer some comment or assist, like the Tomahawk one, it was actually bringing some validity to their scientific workings.
Lisa, just before you do, Lisa...
This is shade.
This is shade.
Yeah.
Do you want to comment about making contact with, you know, afterwards, follow up with the Echo Fund? Would you like to do that first and then I'll ask?
So we have, there have been a few cases like that Tomahawk one, and certainly with the Marine Study Centres where we've maintained a good relationship, and we, you know, look for opportunities where we can keep lending a hand, but we can look at formalising that somehow again.
Maybe I just leave it with you, but I actually think that this shouldn't be a strategy to the side. This should be part of our
Madam Chair, I think just exercising a quick right of reply. I think what Brian has raised is a really, really good point. And just while Shade's here, I'd like to commend her as well, because in our assessment processes, Shade's really good at getting the key people to come in and say, hey, is this on the money? Is this a good idea? Can we help them in some way? So maybe we should build on that. I think we should go away and think about the terms of reference and try to build in what Brian's suggesting there in terms of potential working relationships, not time-demanding ones, but advisory, overview kind of relationships, where our expert staff can help these basically community, volunteer, and often school-based groups to get the maximum out of the money we give them.
Yes.
Because that's what it's about. Maximum, I mean, in terms of ecological return.
Thank you. Yeah, do you want to say anything?
I don't disagree with the sentiment at all. I think it's just really important to understand that the Echo Fund serves a particular purpose. It allows community groups to undertake projects that they see a value in and enjoy. It doesn't necessarily always mean that there is going to be delivered a substantial outcome in terms of some of the way that we're trying to strive towards biodiversity more generally or other things. I think yes, of course we can play a role, and at times we do play a role, and it very much depends on the type of project it is. So I'm not at all suggesting that we wouldn't do that. I am mindful, though, that we're about to bring to you, in the near future anyway, some thinking about how do we actually do biodiversity in this council, because we haven't nailed it yet. And so I think that's quite an important conversation to have. And also, as a part of that, we haven't had our implementation plan yet, an operations plan for our pest plan. So I think that's also a really important conversation to have. So I'm not saying no, but I'm also mindful that we're building some of our capability in the organisation at the moment. But the reason why we're building a lot of that capability right now is because of some of the other work we have to do. So all of that just needs to be taken into account.
Okay.
That's all fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. But are we ready to put the motion?
Yep.
It's been moved and it's been seconded. Councillor Deacon and Councillor Wilson, that the council approves the change to the Echo Fund decision panel terms of reference, to allow the chair to appoint, and notes that once the panel members have accepted the appointment, we're up for a process for the March of 2020. That's my adaptation of the words. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
And against? Carried.